Welcome to the Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. Today we got one of my all-time favorite people. I mean, he's like family to me. He is a legend and a true American hero, retired DEA superstar agent, Frank Panessa. Frank, thank you for joining me.
Hey, how you doing, Scott?
This guy has lived some people have lived one movie script. Some people have lived two. Frank has lived 20. We've had him on the show before, just audio. I don't think we've ever had a video. And if people remember our past appearances or Frank's past appearances on the show, him and I have worked together for the last couple of years in developing his autobiography, which is right now called The Chameleon, and then accompanying, hopefully, a television show that we've had at various stages of development over the last 3 or 4 years with some pretty big people. And I know one way or the other, we're gonna get it to the finish line. But right now, I want to kind of allow Frank to tell a story about it. You know, people that are fans of us, of the show and the pod, know that we love to kind of find a mix and match of history and modern day and try to find kind of connection points. Right now, there's a lot of news out of what I call the Great White North, up in Montreal, a lot of stuff revolving around the Rizzuto crime family, and the Hells Angels, and everybody has been at war with each other over the last 10, 15 years, very unstable. And Frank, and I'm going to shut up and just turn it over to Frank in 10 seconds. Frank, in such an accoladed career, a guy that was common, so many commendations, so many major cases for people that might not know. He was the Pizza Connection case. He broke the Pizza Connection open, the entire heroin pipeline coming from Sicily into the East Coast pizza parlors with the Bonanno crime family and Cesare Bonaventure and Gaetano Badalamenti. That was his case. But he also did undercover work around the globe. And part of his undercover work took him to Montreal, where he infiltrated the Contrera group, which were the precursors to the Rizzutos. That's my preamble. Frank, take it away. Tell us the story.
Yeah. Well, let's start in the famous meeting in Sicily in 1957, where Joe Bonanno, Carmine Galante, Lucky Luciano, Badalamenti, they meet at the Palms Hotel in Sicily. And it was determined that the Bonanno family would control all of the heroin going into the United States, that they would have complete control of heroin distribution to the families in the United States. So what had happened was, one of the first things that they did, Carmine Galante went to Canada, and he got involved with Frank Cotrone. And the big thing that Carmine Galante was doing at the time, Carmine Galante was a psycho, and he used strong arm tactics throughout his whole life. So in Canada, he was in charge of all the gambling, and he was bringing in about $50 million a year for the Cotrones. But because of his strong arm tactics, he was kicked out of Canada. They kicked him out of Canada. The Cotrones continued to bring in, through Badalamenti and other major Sicilians, including the Dosti brothers, Frank Dosti, who grew up with Cotrone. So he was his capo.
So Frank, I want to interrupt you for 1 second. You mentioned Frank Cotrone. So there were a number of Cotrones. They all worked Cotrone together. Brothers. Right. There was Vic Cotrone, who was the godfather, who they called him the egg. And then his baby brother was Frank Catroni, who you just referenced.
That's who I'm talking about.
Who became a very major shot caller in the Montreal Mafia on behalf of his older brother, and was running point for his older brother in that organization on a lot of the narcotics rackets.
Yes, and when I'm referring to Frank Catroni and Frank Dosti, who was his capo. And you have after Catroni died, of course, the Rizzutos took over. That faction took over that part of it. But anyway, now me as an agent in New York in 1968-1969, we see major violators in New York like Guido Pinosi meeting with the Canadians. Now, I'm trying to think.
Pinosi was a Gambino, right?
Yeah, he was Gambino.
They called him the Bull, Guido the Bull Pinosi.
Guido the Bull Pinosi, and he was with Gambino, and there were meetings between Paolo Gambino, who's the brother of Carlo Gambino, Pinosi, and Frank Dosti. Okay, and it was all about doing heroin deals. So we had a surveillance, and I think I'm one of the few people left from the 1969 surveillance of Dosti coming to New York, staying at the Park Sheridan Hotel, okay? And he meets with Guido Pinosi. So we were already on Pinosi, but apparently they must have felt the heat because, again, he came back in May of 69 and again met with Paolo Gambino and Guido Pinosi, and the word was they were doing a 12 kilo heroin deal. Because of the heat, the deals didn't go down, but we got word that Pinosi was going to drive to Montreal, so we figured he's going to pick it up. And instead of them bringing it down, he was going to go to Montreal. So he had a Lincoln, and he was having it serviced at Park Lincoln Mercury. I'll never forget, at the Manhattan-Yonkers line. So we figured one of our bosses says, you know, I know how he's going to get the heroin back into the United States. He's going to put it in the tires of the Lincoln. And so somebody says, it's going to melt if he puts it in. But anyway, the boss says, I want the serial numbers off the tires. So midnight, the doors must have been open at Park Lincoln Mercury because we went right in and got the serial numbers off the tires. Okay. We follow Pinosi to Montreal. And of course, when he's coming back, you know, customs are going to check the serial numbers on the tires and, of course, toss the car. But it was clean. There wasn't anything in it. But the following year, Dosti sends down his guy that distributed heroin. His name was, Lucien Madre. I think it was M-A-D-E-R-E, Madere. And Lucien Madre, and we have surveillance of him meeting with Paul Odo, who was
The Odo. There was an Odo brothers too, Johnny Batbeach Odo, yes, and yeah, exactly. Those guys.
He meets with them at the Sheridan Hotel. We pop them, and in Madere's car, we get 10 kilos of heroin. Okay, so I feel that during that 2-year period, they were bringing a load of heroin into the United States, and we were missing it. You know, we were lucky to capture these three meetings and to follow Guido up to Montreal. So they were doing major heroin.
Did you get to go? You went up to Montreal personally. Can you talk about what was the landscape like up there, and kind of compare and contrast it?
I didn't go into Montreal.
Oh, you didn't go over the border?
No. We followed him up to the line.
Up to the line, all right.
Yeah, and he went into Canada. And then there were reports by the Canadian Mounted Police of the surveillance.
Yeah.
But I personally didn't go into Canada.
Did you ever, I know you said Dosti came down to New York.
We were on surveillance on Dosti at the Park Sheridan in 1969, two times in 69. As I say, the first time he met with Guido Pinosi. The second time in August of 69, he met with Guido Pinosi and Paolo Gambino.
And are you saying that Paolo Gambino was Carlo's brother, or was he
brother? I think he was his brother.
Well, because there was also the cousins that were the Cherry Hill Gambinos.
Oh, no, I knew them.
That you're saying that's separate. Years okay.
Later, I knew them, but for some reason, it's Paolo. I'm positive it was his brother Paolo. They must have been a brother. But then, in August of that year, we find Frank Dosti at. I'm trying to think who was killed. What was his name?
It was Palmieri.
Jimmy Palmieri was murdered in 71, and he was part of the Lucchese family.
Okay.
Palmieri.
Right.
And we find Frank Dosti at his funeral in 71. So we had I had three occasions to see Dosti in New York.
It was Jimmy Palmieri? We're talking about Johnny Palmieri.
Jimmy Palmieri.
Jimmy Palmieri?
Yeah.
And you surveilled the wake?
Funeral. The wake.
Where was it at?
I'm pretty sure it was in Brooklyn. I can't remember. You know, going back to 1971.
And I think they called him Jimmy Higgins. I think that was his nickname.
No, he was called Jimmy called something else. I can't think of it.
I know that Jimmy Higgins was one of his aliases. Nonetheless, he was a Gambino drug lieutenant.
Yeah. Okay.
And the notion, it's also, I want to get your take on this, Frank. It's interesting to think about. You know, when Carlo was the godfather, obviously everybody had the lip service towards no drugs, but everybody knew that a lot of these godfathers that were espousing drugs were actually benefiting greatly from drugs. The Carlo Gambino, his own family,
Cherry Hill Gambino, right, we're doing this.
But then 10 years later, you had Paul Castellano that ostensibly wanted to kill Gotti and his guys for dealing dope. So did you, at the time, was it something that like you realized in regards to the Italians that you were working, that on one hand it was considered a cardinal sin, but on the other hand, like on one hand you're hearing from, tell me if I'm wrong. On one hand, you're hearing from sources that the powers that be are saying it's a cardinal sin to deal, but then on the other hand you're seeing all those people that are being told it's a cardinal sin to deal
and I'm buying dope from them,
right,
that's the thing. But it was interesting because they all said no, they're not involved. And as I say, I was involved with probably all five families doing dope, you know, in New York at the time. And I as I say, the Cherry Hill Gambinos were very much involved in that.
Another interesting tie, Frank, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but Pinosi, his drug dealing activity took him coast to coast.
Oh yeah, he was involved with the Shakedown of Wayne Newton too.
Right, and that right Shakedown of Wayne Newton in Vegas,
Los Angeles. I mean, in Las Vegas,
but also in L.A. I have a bunch of DEA reports. I did a little article on this a couple of years ago, but I have a bunch of DEA reports about how Pinocchi was supplying cocaine to like the entire sitcom lineup on ABC, which in the 70s was huge. It was like Mork and Mindy, Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, and he had a guy. I can't remember his name, but he played the dad on Laverne and Shirley. He played Laverne's dad.
Oh yeah, I know.
His name was Phil something. Yeah, I'm blanking on his last name.
I know who you mean.
He was buddies with Pinocchi.
He had a restaurant.
He was buddies with Pinocchi, and Pinocchi would come into LA from New York with a bunch of dope, and they take him on into the studio, and he'd be supplying Robin Williams and all the people on Happy Days and Mork and Mindy. It's crazy to hear you talk about Guido Pinocchi from that aspect in New York, and then knowing that in that same time period he's supplying guys, actors and actresses that were like American icons.
He was a mover and a shaker.
Yeah.
And I honestly believe they were bringing in so much heroin from Montreal. I mean, we were missing it. Let's face it. We were missing a lot of it. And we were lucky when we got this guy, Lucian Madere and Odo with the 10 kilos, you know. So you can imagine every time Lucian came down from Montreal, he was carrying at least 10 kilos.
The actor's name was Phil Foster. I just looked. I don't think that was his real name. I think he had an Italian surname, his stage name was Phil Foster.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, you know, all the other big names too during this time frame. You know, Badalamenti was very much involved. Buscetta, Tommaso Buscetta was very much involved. You had actually the pizza restaurants already going. You know, I didn't get involved into the pizza restaurants until 83. But way before that, they had all the distribution restaurants around the United States. And the one interesting thing that we saw, that the Sicilian mafia controlled all the heroin importation, and they supplied the American mafia families with the heroin. People don't understand that there's two mafias, you know, the Sicilian and the American mafia, and they use one another for their own profits. And the American mafia was also using the zips, as we call them, the people that work in these pizza shops, to do hits for them too, you know?
Well, they were Sicilians that had come over to America to work for some of these American crime families, and then they kind of became, in some cases, mini crime families within bigger crime families.
Oh, yeah.
Very insular. And I want to segue this for you. We'll go for another 10-20 minutes. And for let people know that Frank had a alias, an undercover persona known as Frankie Pizza, Frankie Pagano, who they called Frankie Pizza. Obviously, Donnie Brasco gets a lot more publicity, but just so, and we've said this before, for people that were listening, I don't know if people on YouTube have heard it, but there would be no Donnie Brasco if it wasn't for Frankie Pizza, Frankie Pagano. I don't say that with any slight against Joe Pistone, but Frank, you know, he wrote the book literally on federal undercover law enforcement and how to go after the Italian mafia, and planted a lot of the seeds in the early 70s for what became the FBI Donnie Brasco investigation into the Bananos in the late 70s, early 80s. And Frank was dealing, literally and figuratively, had got his hooks into subordinates of Cesare Bonventri, who was the main zip Bonanno Capo had been Carmine Galante's bodyguard, was involved in a conspiracy to murder Galante.
We were into Cesare Bonaventure and Baldo Amato.
Yeah.
And they were distributing the heroin through the pizza shops. And I got involved in Philadelphia in the pizza shops. And the heroin was coming straight from Cesare Bonaventure. And in a year's time, I bought over $1 million worth of heroin from the Bonanno family, you know, Cesare Bonaventure and all the people that were involved with him. And of course, you had Castellano in Brooklyn, and they controlled, you know, all the distribution in New York. Interesting time.
I don't know if people know. I learned this from Frank. I think everybody knew that part of that pizza connection. I mean, it's not breaking news or anything. Everybody knew that part of that pizza connection, which was centered around the Bonannos, Manhattan, Brooklyn, and obviously they were spread across New Jersey. They were involved with the Gambino and the Cherry Hill group. But I don't know if people realize that some of Bonaventure's guys, these Sicilian gangsters, were in Philadelphia, not working for Nicky Scarfo or Phil Testa or Angelo Bruno, but working for the Bonannos in Philly. Dominic Massimino, I believe, was one of the big ones. They called him Mimi Massimino. Yeah. And he owned a lot of those pizza parlors, but he was based in Philly.
Dominic Menino, too.
That's what I'm sorry. I didn't mean Massimino. I meant Dominic Menino, who they called Mimi. I was confusing him with Mousy Massimino. No, Dominic Menino, a.k.a. Mimi, who was Cesare's main guy in Philly. I didn't even know that the Bonannos had a group in Philly, but Frank was working them. And Frank was, and tell them, I apologize for people that might have heard some of the audio in years past, but I want Frank to tell it for the new video audience. But tell them how your entry point for some of these guys in the Bonannos was pretending like you were a Scarfo lieutenant.
Yeah.
And back then it was a lot more difficult to backcheck things back then. And you played the role. And they thought you were a capo under Nicky Scarfo.
They never questioned it. Right. It was so good. We had arrested two wise guys in Philadelphia, two Bruno people. And so we're saying, hey, you know, you're going to go to jail if you don't cooperate. So they said, well, we're not going to give you anybody in the Bruno family. So I said to them, well, what about the Sicilians? And so the one guy says to me, well, they're not Italian. Yeah,
yeah. They're not Italian like us. They're Sicilian.
So we came up with the story that I was a made guy in Philadelphia, and I was in charge of all hijacking, because we knew they had cigarette machines. They had 80 cigarette machines in restaurants around Philadelphia. You know, when you walked into the vestibule, you had the machine where you pulled the lever to get the cigarettes. Well, they had 80 of them. So these guys approach one of the Bonanno people and say, hey, you know, this guy, Frankie Pagano, just hijacked a big shipment of cigarettes. Would you be interested in it? And so, of course, they said, yeah. So at the time, they were paying $7.10 a carton, legitimately buying the cigarettes to put in their machines. So what we came up with the idea, we would offer them the cigarettes at $4 a carton, right off the $3.10 a carton as an investigative expense, and make me somebody. So they set up a meeting to meet with the Sicilians, and the Sicilians meet us at a mob restaurant in Philadelphia. Now you have me and an agent that was, in quotes, my bodyguard behind me, and these two guys from Philly. And the Sicilians are sitting across the table from us. And so the wise guy from Philly says to the Sicilians, "This is Frankie Pagano. He's a friend of ours," meaning that I'm a made guy. If he would have said, "This is Frankie Pagano, he's a friend of mine," that means I'm associated,
right?
But I'm not made. So the Sicilians saw this, and then, of course, the Sicilians saw these two guys serving me drinks. When the food came out, they made sure I was the first to get the food. So I started selling them cigarettes. And after about 4 or 5 months, you know, I did my sad face, and I said to the Sicilian, he says, "What's wrong with me?" He used to call me Cugina, cousin. I says, "Well, you know, I get involved in other stuff." He says, "What do you mean?" I says, "You know, I'm involved in white powder." "Well, why didn't you tell me? We control all the white powder." So he says, "Who you buying from?" So at the time, I was buying off somebody in the Genovese family in New York who we hadn't arrested. So I says, "Oh, I'm getting it off so-and-so in the Bronx." He says, "He gets it from us. From now on, you get it from us." And that's how the Pizza Connection started. A short time later, I made my first buy of $85,000. And I was in. And they never questioned, who I was. And it's funny, because we used to hang out at an after-hours place. And you'd have the Bruno family there, you know, with Nicky Scarfo and all them. And I'd be with the Sicilians. So the Sicilians never went over to the Bruno family and says, "Hey, well, we're just..."
Yeah, right. Pagano. It could have gotten hairy.
I would have said, "Take cuts to Frankie Pagano. Who's he?"
Right. You know?
So that never happened. And there, everything, they confided in me. We went to Europe. We supplied them with Cesare Bonaventure with quinine, you know, to cut the heroin. It was really good.
Didn't you tell me at one point, Frank, that before, so Cesare goes down in that big Pizza Connection bus, but for people that know the history of the Pizza Connection and Cesare, he didn't make it to trial. He was murdered.
Oh, he never did.
For insubordination. He had gotten, there was a lot of friction after the Galante assassination, and yeah. Bonaventure became, I think at the time he was the youngest capo.
No, he was
in New York City. He was only 25 years old.
That's all.
And he was a capo. A lot of power went to his head, and he started butt heads with Phil Rastelli, who was Galante's successor.
Yeah, he did. But the thing was, Cesare turned out to be just like Lilo Galante. He was money hungry.
Right.
They were bringing in $1 million a day on the heroin trade, and yet he was shortchanging everybody below him. I remember I bought a package from LaPorta.
This is the story I wanted people to tell. Or I wanted you to tell. That's what I was leading up to. So tell the story. Yeah.
The original heroin that I bought was 90-something percent pure, which is normal. You know, you never get like 100%, but 90% is pure heroin. And me, as a dope dealer, I could cut that and I could make millions of dollars with it. So I did one deal with the Sicilians and it came back 32%. And so I complained. I says, "What are you giving me this crap for? I can't make any money with this." He says, "That's what Cesare gave us. And we have to take what he gives us, you know?" But the Sicilian, I mean, I was their golden goose in Philadelphia. Anybody that's buying $1 million worth of heroin is their golden goose. So about a week later, I meet with one of the Sicilians and he hands me $16,000. I says, "What's this?" He says, "Well, you know, I feel bad that the last package was so bad, but I don't have any control over it. It's Cesare calls the shots." And he handed me $16,000. But that was Cesare's downfall.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that that played a role in some of the cumulative, it was a culmination, I think, of a number of factors that led to his murder. But I know that part of the issue where he was being called, when Cesare was being called on the carpet and having to answer to Rusty, was related to he was ripped. He wasn't, I think in some ways he might have looked at you as, you know, I don't, these are guys that are my guys that I'm giving, and he wouldn't necessarily think possibly that it was a slap in the face to you. He didn't know you personally. I heard he was doing this to guys that were big shots in the Bananos, were getting cheated in deals by him. And that was part of the reason Rusty had him at a sit down, which allegedly
let Bonanno.
Right. Well, and Cesare, from what I can gather, the final straw was a situation where he told Rusty Ristella to go fuck himself and stormed out of a sit down. And that's then they killed him a couple weeks later, telling him that they were taking him back to see Rusty so he could apologize, or they could make nice, and they killed him.
Yeah. And they chopped him up and put him in 355-gallon drums. He was a tall guy. He was like 6'5", 6'6".
Yeah.
He was a tall Sicilian.
I want to, let's wrap this up with, let's keep it in Philly as we end. And I want you to tell the story, and I'll color it up a little bit. But 1983, this is right before the bust is going to come down in 84. And you're out with some guys in a club, and the Selena brothers are spotted, and they kind of tell you something that's about to happen. And then it happened.
And it happens. Yeah. We were in a private club called Club Enchanté in Cherry Hill. And as I say, you had the Bruno people in there, Nicky Scarfo, I say the Bruno family, meaning Nicky Scarfo and all those people. And you had the Sicilians, okay? And so Alberto Ficalora says, you see those two guys over there? And he points to the Selena brothers. And he says, they've shown no respect. He says, we're men of honor, and they show no respect. And that's what he said to me. A month later, they were both killed.
Yep, Maddie and Toto.
Yeah, a month apart from one another.
It might have been less than a month, but around
these were tough people. These Sicilians were tough.
And just to tie it into today, Ace was eventually dropped, but initially, Joe Legambi, who would become the boss of the Philadelphia mob, is now like a part-time consigliere, a very, very esteemed member of the East Coast Mafia, very, very well respected. He was indicted for this murder, or for, I should say, for one of the murders. I don't know if it was for Maddie or for Toto, but him and Yogi Merlino, who was the alleged current boss of the Philly mob, Joey Merlino's uncle, Yogi and Uncle Joe Legambi were indicted for the murder conspiracy of the Selena brothers. I believe that they were tasked with, they played some role in taking the body from where it was killed to where it was found.
They put them in the trunk of a car. And they found them in the cars.
Yeah, so Toto Selena was found in Deptford, Juniper Court, Gloucester County. Was stuffed in two plastic trash bags in the trunk of his 79 Cadillac.
Yes.
And then Maddie had been murdered or had been disappeared like a month before that, I think. And they found him in a trunk. As of November of 83, he was still missing.
No, but then they did find him.
Right. So it's just interesting to see how, Joe Legambi, who would eventually rise to pretty historic heights, could have been tripped up by that murder. He was eventually convicted later in that decade of the Frankie Flowers murder, got out of that in 97 on an appeal, and then had his ascent. But I also was told that that might have been a way for Legambi to get made, was to be involved in the Selena hit.
Oh, I believe that. You know,
but then it took him another 3 years, though, because of his connection to Chucky Merlino, and Merlino ended up getting demoted. They wanted to keep Merlino's guys at a distance for a while. But it's interesting that Legambi kind of plays a role in some of this old school stuff.
You know, you have to understand, during that time, I'm talking about 1982, 1983, when I was in undercover, there were 22 hits around me.
Yeah.
22 people got hit. You know, talking about the Testas and, of course, originally Angelo Bruno, but then Phil Testa and everybody that came
His son, Salvia.
You know?
Well, Frank, this was great, man. We're gonna bring you back again. I'm excited for the video audience to get a look at you, because we've only really been doing video for a little over a year now, and we're getting a whole new audience, whole new group of people that didn't really know about us when we were just audio. So we'll bring you back on, and then you'll be hearing hopefully a lot more about Frank's project, his story about his life, book form, television, that we're both of us are working on. To say that Frank had a storied life or a storied career in federal law enforcement is a gross understatement. He is truly a legend in DEA circles, and like I said, he literally wrote the book on how to do undercover work at the federal level. So we pay a debt to Frank, and hey man, thank you so much for coming on and shedding insight and telling everybody your amazing life stories.
Okay, Scott, take care.
All right, so I will see you next week. I am Scott Bernstein, another long form edition. We'll see you next week, but we'll be coming out with some quick hitters every day or two, as we normally do. OG Pod for Benny Behind the Glass. I am Scott Bernstein.